Behind the Lines.
Inside the Newsroom. From Guardian Australia.
Hi, welcome to Behind the Lines. I'm Gabrielle Jackson.
And I'm Miles Martignoni.
And this episode, we're going down to the Festival of Dangerous Ideas that's just been held at the Sydney Opera House.
Yeah, I went down and I recorded a session we put on. It was called How Can We Solve the Asylum Seeker Crisis?
Wow, that sounds interesting. Yeah, Anyone have any ideas?
It's a pretty big question to ask people. It was an interesting event because we had a lot of specialists come in and talk about their field and all come up with at least one idea of how to make things better. But what was the coolest thing we did was we actually got the public to kind of form into workshop groups and kind of brainstorm ideas that might be able to help solve this problem.
And were there any good ideas?
There were some great ideas. Someone suggested that every member of parliament needs to visit a detention centre. There's more accountability because we're spending a lot of money on it and there's a lot of humanitarian costs happening there. So every single person who votes for things in parliament should really go there to see what it's really like. Someone else came up with an idea for a national day that would help symbolize us that having open borders by leaving their door open one evening. So everyone would leave their door open one evening and maybe people would get to visit each other, like open our own borders.
Right.
The funniest idea, which I think is actually the one that might work, is to make popular television shows about refugees, like having a refugee bachelor or a refugee wants a wife type show.
Or a husband.
or a husband. And so to bring in those formats and
fantastic.
Yeah, I know. It's such a funny idea.
Like, and how did the experts receive that idea?
I think everyone had a good laugh. But I think someone should take that seriously because, how else are you going to try and change people's minds than to, insert these people's stories into mainstream culture? Mm. And what do most people watch? They watch these mass reality television show formats in the millions. And so that's probably the best place to try and reach them if you can convince them. And I think those smart TV executives that have all these successes could find a way to do it.
Mm. And so what about the speakers, the experts? What did they have to say about the issue?
It was great because they each had a really tight presentation. They had one idea. And I'll actually let David Marr explain all of this because he moderated the whole session. It was fantastic to have him there. I'm going to start with him actually setting the scene because he had some really interesting things to say about how Australians' minds have changed about this issue over the past few years.
Since it set up shop in Australia a few years ago, The Guardian has broken story after story about the camps on Manus and Nauru. The Brits who came out here from head office to set up the website were shocked in ways Australian editors no longer are. They were amazed, really, to discover that Australia was running an immigration gulag in the Pacific. First, the doctors came to us and we broke their stories of mistreatment of detainees on Christmas Island. The psychiatrist Peter Young, who had been the head of psychiatric services for IHMS, the medical provider to the detention system, came to us and calmly argued that Australia is torturing its detainees. The psychologist Paul Stevenson came to us with his accounts of trauma and distress. And then, early last month, in one of the greatest leaks of the decade in Australian journalism, The Guardian published 2,116 incident reports showing in excruciating, in shameful detail, the regime Australia imposes year by year and day by day on asylum seekers that we've exiled to Nauru. And how did Australia respond? Well, we know the answer to that precisely because Essential, the very reputable polling company Essential, asked Australians soon after the Guardian series finished. What they found is rather dispiriting. They showed that in the aftermath of the Guardian reports, more Australians than ever, up 6 points to 46%, recognised conditions on Manus and Nauru are poor. We're not blind, we can see what's going on, but Essential also discovered that the result of the Guardian series was to harden our hearts a little. Essential found Essential found in the last weeks of last month. Fewer of us, not more, but fewer than before, think Australia is being too tough on the prisoners of Manus and Nauru. Here are the figures. Essential last polled these questions in November 2014, so a little less than 12 months ago. Then and now, 29% of Australians reckon that we are being too soft on boat arrival refugees. Too soft. Almost exactly the same number, 31% of us, then and now, perfectly steady result, believe indefinitely imprisoning asylum seekers on remote tropical islands with no prospect of resettlement is taking the right approach. That's 60% of us either applauding the government or urging even harsher measures. So how many of us are actually troubled by what's going on? Well, last November, the figure was 25%. A quarter of Australians were troubled by what's going on in Manus and Nauru. After The Guardian's magnificent work last month, the ranks of the troubled slipped to 21%, one in five. Don't be sentimental about the Labor Party. Only 29% of Labor voters think, even in the light of the latest Guardian revelations, that we're too tough on refugees. Only 29%. And make no mistake about the attitude of coalition voters. Essential discovered that in late August, only 9% of them think Australia is being too tough to the refugees it detains on Manus and Nauru. I wouldn't be a journalist if I didn't think that reporting the truth leads, if not immediately, then eventually, to change. That is not the case here. Truth-telling doesn't seem to work. In the 15 years since Tampa, facts have had little traction. And frankly, it shakes my faith in what I do, in my trade. It used to be that when the boats went away, our fears died. Our better natures were restored. We became kinder people. Cruelty only surfaced when the boats came back. But that's not the case anymore. There have been no boats arriving, setting out but not arriving, for over 3 years. Yet the nation's attitudes are set fast, stuck at cruel. The press has failed to budge public opinion. Politics has failed to budge the verdict of Australia, and the courts have failed as well. So I have high hopes that this morning, this room can, between us, find ways where we might move forward in this to meet this intractable moral and political challenge. We begin with four speakers. Shukufa Tahiri is one of the many Hazara people who have fled Afghanistan and are making distinguished lives in this country. She is at the moment studying law. She is supporting refugees, advocating for refugees. She's working on interpreting services, tuition for kids with refugee backgrounds. And she's also a policy assistant at the Refugee Council of Australia. Shukufa Tahiri.
Today, three times the population of our country, Australia, are displaced from their homes and their communities. That is 65 million people displaced globally, the highest level of displacement ever recorded. Turning the time machine a little bit back to 1999, this was my story too. My family was displaced by the horrors unfolding in Afghanistan when the Taliban came into power. My father was compelled to cross the seas on a leaky boat for 7 days. He floated with tides and storms and made it to Australia while we, the family, sat with our horror for him in Quetta, Pakistan. As the international community grappled with the challenges of responding to multiple crises, simultaneously and meeting the needs of unprecedented numbers of displaced people, over the past 2 decades, Australia's response to the arrival of asylum seekers by boat have concentrated overwhelmingly on policies of deterrence. We've built a virtual wall and have pretended that this is a domestic challenge to keep away the world's most vulnerable people who've come to us begging for security and protection. Today, Australia uses its military. Think about that. I was a beneficiary of a welcome that did not traumatize me, that dignified and recognized my humanity. But my father was treated with contempt, labeled an illegal, a potential threat to Australia's national security. There are now thousands of victims like my father who are blamed for the violence and vitriol and for the acts of the very perpetrators they're fleeing from. Asylum seekers are made the scapegoats by placing the existential societal anxiety into a defense of national integrity, here in the form of border security. The external other that is threatening to invade and disrupt our livelihoods and our cohesion. Today in Australia, we have two groups of refugees. We have good refugees and bad refugees. I was a good refugee, and my father was a bad refugee. Yet we fled the same horrors and persecution in Afghanistan. The difference? He jumped the mythical, orderly queue reserved for people fleeing persecution, and he made that flight by boat to Australia. As such, on the one hand, we extend the generous hand to refugees and pat ourselves on the back for being generous, while we push back and punish people with the other hand without any contempt or guilt. While doing this, we spend billions to inhumanely punish asylum seekers and thousands of people as hostages in Australia fleeing persecution for the sake of deterrence. We are creating a cohort of damaged generation with a great cost, and a cost that is not only financial. The semantics of illegal further fuels and legitimizes the dichotomy of good refugee and a bad refugee. Through such language comes the hostile attitude to these uninvited foreigners. The presumed political implications encourage the nasty language and adds further unnecessary cruelty to the policy. More and more, we see the perpetual peddling of those fears and anxieties created in the two last decades by leaders and people of influence. It is then the combination of language and an inherent prejudicial attitude created by such language that creates the cruelty and dehumanization in our policies, which is further perpetuated by politicians and the mass media, insidiously becoming part of a national mindset. George Orwell said it well: if thought corrupts language, language can also corrupt thought. We've all seen the unfolding of Nauru files by The Guardian. We've all seen the evidence of abuse, self-harm, and re-traumatization and self-immolation from utter desperation in offshore detention centers. We've also seen the desensitization of our leaders and our public, because pushing this group of people to the point of utter desperation is the essential part of the policy game plan. Offering the worst has become the logic of asylum seeker policy in our country, based on the rationality of deterrence. The more desperation, the more triumphant we will feel about our policies working and not failing. While the politics of fear is winning the hearts and minds of many, a fundamental question that ought to be asked is, how threatening would this illegal asylum seeker be if you have them sit right in front of you? Well, I am the daughter of that threatening boat person who came here illegally. So far, our approach has been keeping the illegal at bay in the deserts surrounded by razor wire, drawing them as an abstract threat that should be kept out of sight and therefore as far away as possible out of our minds. These are not an abstract criminal group anymore. They are here and with us, though, 30,000 of them here in the community, who are either caught in the many years of processing limbo or in detention, facing irreparable trauma. My father, back in the 2000s, was one of them. It is not the policy that we need to change, though. It's not only the policy. We need to change the way we understand the other, why we're scared of them, and what we need to do to reframe and how we consider the issue entirely if we have to move forward. It is the principle and not political expedience where we need to start from. Australia's current policies erode our national reputation, our image as a generous nation, and cause great damage to many people and cost our taxpayers billions of dollars. Most worryingly, Australia's brutal treatment of people seeking asylum undermines any possible shift to a sustainable solution or sustainable approach, and sends a message to the world that unilateral action might work without responsibility sharing and cooperation with our neighbours, region and the rest of the world in the face of such crisis. The truth is, it is only through working together that the world will resolve the challenge of displacement. Australia's current policies deny us the opportunity to engage with our region, to promote practical solutions instead of exploiting our weaker neighbours for our ends. We need to get people thinking beyond the idea that everyone is trying to get to Australia and work with our region and the broader global community to ensure people can live a life with dignity and access to basic necessities in countries of first asylum. The fact is, the world is faced with a great challenge in the mass displacement we are facing now, yet the reality too is we must deal with it. We must listen to the call by academics for a national summit. It seems insurmountable when there are 24 million refugees in the world, but today in the world we have 7 billion people. We could ensure that every single one of them lived with dignity if we wanted to. Our challenge is one of policy, but it's also to make them want that to happen. We need better and more constructive bipartisan leadership. The death of leaders like Malcolm Fraser has left a vacuum that has not been filled. In fact, the increasing complex world we live in and the consequent policy challenges for our politicians are adding up. The true crisis lies in the leadership and the language with which we refer to asylum seekers. Thank you.
Shakufa, thank you. Daniel Webb is our next speaker. Daniel is from the Human Rights Law Centre. He's the Director of Legal Advocacy there, and he's most recently been in the High Court challenging the offshore detention regime in the plaintiff M68 case, and he was also involved in the case challenging the detention of 157 people at sea. You'll remember that story of the Australian Border Force intercepting those 157 people and holding them secretly at sea, secretly until the press finally got hold of information. Daniel has worked in Kiribati, in Cambodia, in PNG. He's worked in the field of native title as well as in the field of refugees. Ladies and gentlemen, Daniel Webb.
It's fantastic to be here to talk about alternative policies. It's a conversation that we can't shy away from. It's a conversation that we really need to have because the current arrangements on Nauru and Manus are dead ends. They always have been, and they grow more and more untenable by the day. The highest court in PNG has said the Manus camp is illegal. The companies operating both centres have said they're walking away, despite the very bleak public opinion polling numbers that David set out earlier. Slowly but surely, public opinion is shifting, and most importantly, every day, innocent people are suffering. As we look at alternative policy options, for me, there's one thing that is absolutely crucial to bear in mind. For all of the huff and puff and white noise about borders and boats, this is fundamentally about people. You wouldn't know it when you listen to the government. Think about the language and the images that they use. Australian Border Force, Operation Sovereign Borders, Stop the Boats. No mention at all of people. Look at the boat in this, if you can see it, in this infamous government ad that they've spruiked all around the world. There's no people on the boat. They've photoshopped the people out of the picture. Yet people is what this is about. And I want to introduce you to some of them. They're men that I met on Manus just a couple of weeks ago. We often talk about how these guys are victims of mistreatment by us. But when you meet them, it's abundantly clear that they're also lost opportunities for us. Recognizing their potential and their determination to contribute helps reveal what I think is the way forward. This is Aziz. Aziz is a refugee from Sudan. He speaks 7 languages, 2 of which he taught himself while locked up on Manus. For three years, Aziz has spent 1 hour every morning and 1 hour every night going through language lessons he's downloaded off the internet. He jokes that his friends think he's crazy because he goes to bed every night speaking Spanish to his pillow. This is Imran from Burma. Imran didn't speak one word of English when we locked him up on Manus. He's now written a book, an autobiography of his life. He taught himself English by writing a page every day using a dictionary and pestering his friends to correct all the mistakes. He shyly told me, "My first page had only 8 lines and 26 mistakes. But page 1100 is much better. Still not perfect, though, because you can never stop learning." Imran has now been published by The Guardian. Finally, this is Ben. Ben loved school, but he had to leave at 16 to support his family, who were really poor. He worked every day at a local market, wholesaling plastics to other stores. He told me with great pride and a beaming smile that by working hard, he made enough money to keep his younger sister in school. Thanks to his hard work and his determination, Ben's little sister had the education that he was denied. This is just 3 of the guys on Manus. I also met a stand-up comic, an artist, a journalist, a civil engineer, a hairdresser and a chef. All truly impressive people in their own right. People who've found themselves in horrible circumstances throughout their lives, but who against the odds have innovated and persevered. They didn't want to come by boat. They were terrified. The first time Aziz got on a boat, it sunk. And 5 of his closest friends died, but he still felt he had no other choice but to risk his life and try again. The reality is these guys lacked alternatives, and therein lies the flaw in our brutish, deterrence-based approach. We use cruel measures to close existing pathways. We should be looking at innovative ways to open up new ones. And our migration intake, our huge migration intake, is a fantastic and an underutilised tool at our disposal. Look at the numbers just from this 1 year, 2014-15. In that 1 year alone, we had permanent migration of 202,000 people, skilled migration places and some family visas, 202,000. We also had temporary migration of 395,000. So that's mostly students and people on temporary work visas. In total, 600,000 people in 1 year. Our refugee intake was 2.3% of that. That little black bar you see at the bottom of the third column on the graph, that's our refugee intake. 13,756 people, 2.3%. Now, of course, who we take, where we take them from, what skills they have, that's all driven by a range of economic considerations, while our refugee intake is driven by humanitarian imperatives. But here's the dangerous idea. Why don't we stop assuming these things are completely mutually exclusive? Many of the guys I met on Manus would have an awful lot to contribute if given the chance. Of course, there's humanitarian responsibilities in all of this, and I'm not saying we should just cherry pick which people deserve safety, but as well as humanitarian responsibilities, there are opportunities if we are prepared to think outside the box. Bearing in mind that most people who seek our protection transit through Indonesia and Malaysia, here's what I think we should do. First, protect their dignity At the moment, asylum seekers in Indonesia and Malaysia can't work, can't access basic health services, their kids can't go to school, they're at risk of being locked up. They're in a precarious limbo. We can and should work with the UN and the governments of these countries to deliver a package of practical measures protecting basic dignity, ensuring they're safe, ensuring they're not imprisoned, ensuring their basic needs and rights are met, helps alleviate the pressure to leave. Second, their refugee claims need to be processed. People in transit have to be on a pathway to refugee status. So we should help and resource the UN and the governments of these countries to process people quickly and fairly. Like with this first measure of protecting dignity, a real sense of progress, a sense of being on a pathway, helps alleviate the pressure to leave. Third and finally, we need to open resettlement pathways. Once people are on a fair and dignified path, the path's got to lead somewhere. And this is where our migration intake comes in. We should reallocate some skilled migration places to people with the same skills that we're looking for, but who also happen to be seeking asylum. We should look at opening up options for communities and private sponsors to bring refugees to Australia. And of course, we should increase our humanitarian intake. It's also important to remember we don't have to do any of this alone. When we start to show leadership, when we start to do some of this stuff ourselves, then all of a sudden we've got the credibility to go to countries like New Zealand, who currently take a miserly 750 refugees a year, and ask them to follow our lead. The bottom line is this. The issue's about people. Continuing to punish them isn't the solution. Alternatives do exist. Central to them is understanding the undeniable potential for refugees to enrich our communities and their determination to do so. Thank you.
Jane McAdam. Jane is the Scientia Professor of Law and the Director of the Andrew and Renata Caldor Centre for International Refugee Law at the University of New South Wales. She's also a non-resident fellow of the Brookings Institution. She is the Editor-in-Chief of the International Journal of Refugee Law. She publishes, she argues in this field continuously. We're extremely pleased that Jane will be the first of our speakers this morning. Jane.
What would a principled asylum policy look like in Australia? It would comply with the letter and the spirit of international law. It would take account of best practice from other countries and past policies, learning lessons from history. It would emphasise protection over deterrence, recognising that the latter doesn't stop people who are in need of protection from seeking safety, however dangerous the journey might be. It would respect the principle of family unity, and it would be founded on respect for human dignity and the premise that every person should be able to live a safe and dignified life. So what do we need to do? Well, I was asked, what's one thing that you would do now that could change Australia's approach to refugees? We could insert a provision into the Migration Act that reads as follows. This Act must be interpreted in accordance with Australia's responsibilities under international refugee law and international human rights law in good faith. And what would the upshot of this be? It would mean that refugees would live amongst us in the Australian community, not in mandatory detention, unless particular individuals were shown to be a particular risk. It would mean that offshore processing couldn't continue in its current form. It would mean that principled, effective, and transparent refugee status determination procedures in Australia would recommence, with full merits review and full judicial review. It would mean that families couldn't be separated. It would mean that children's best interests would be a primary consideration in every decision concerning them. It would mean that people couldn't be turned back at sea without the opportunity to articulate their protection claim with proper procedural safeguards. It would also mean that by modelling protection in action and best practice Australia could help to develop the regional protection space, an opportunity that I think we've squandered in recent years. This would also mean that refugees would be welcomed far more quickly into Australian society, and that this would lead to greater economic, cultural, and social benefits over time. There are many studies, both here and overseas, that show while the short-term settlement reception can be difficult for people, given the circumstances they fled, given that they may not have English language skills, or that their qualifications might not be recognised. Over time, it is very clear that refugees achieve enormous outcomes on these measures and others. And in fact, the evidence in Australia shows that by the second generation, refugees are generally outperforming the migrant and native-born population. What a change in policy like this would also mean is that Australia would regain our international reputation as a welcoming country that respects human rights and that respects the rule of law. And we'd also save a lot of money. The evidence also tells us that whereas it costs around $400,000 a year to hold an asylum seeker in detention offshore, it costs around $40,000 a year to allow an asylum seeker to live in the community on a bridging visa. So that's my one idea about how we could shift the frame in Australia and create a policy that is sustainable, that is humane, and that complies with international law. Thank you very much for your attention.
Jeff Gilbert's official title is Professor of Law in the School of Law and Human Rights Centre at the University of Essex, but everybody who has been working in this field, interested in this field over the last 10 or 15 years, knows that Jeff is one of the principal speakers, writers, advocates of international legal solutions to refugee problems. He has been consulting to UNHCR. He has also been invited by the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung to present papers in Manila and Canberra, all around the place. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very pleased to welcome Jeff Gilbert.
You might think that someone from Europe would want to speak about the refugee situation that's going on in Europe at the moment. But why focus there? We've just heard that there's about 65.8 million forcibly displaced persons of concern to UNHCR at the moment. 86% of the world's refugees are in developing countries. The least developed host 26% of refugees. Lebanon has 183 refugees for every 1,000 people. Coming in second in that table, Jordan with 87 per 1,000. And in third, Nauru with 50 for every 1,000. Funny how so many refugees can find this small island in the Pacific, really, isn't it? By the way, if you want an idea of the Global North's response, coming in at 9th and 10th are Sweden and Malta, respectively, both with 17 per 1,000. 51% of refugees are under 18. The top six refugee-hosting countries are Turkey, Pakistan, Lebanon, Iran, Ethiopia, and Jordan. Don't see the United Kingdom, don't see Canada, and quite obviously, given this conference meeting today, unlikely to see Australia in that list. Thank you, David, for the lovely introduction. You mentioned that I've consulted for UNHCR. In 2014-15, I had the privilege of undertaking a consultancy for UNHCR, looking at how rule of law could be used to seek solutions for refugees. with my fellow consultant and co-researcher, Anna Magdalena Rusch, we went to Niger and to Colombia. Niger in 2014 and 2015, I haven't checked for 2016, was the poorest country on the planet, 187th out of 187 in UNDP's humanitarian index. And yet it receives refugees from Mali in the north, who are fleeing Al-Qaeda of the Islamic Maghreb, and from Nigeria in the south, fleeing Boko Haram. We went to Difa, which is in the southeast. It's the poorest part of Niger. It's 5 kilometres from the Nigerian border. We could see Boko Haram watching us. The people there allowed those who had been displaced from Nigeria to build their shelters up against their own houses. UNHCR provided some breeze blocks and some other materials, and the refugees built themselves their own accommodation in the villages. And the chef de village would allow the children, the young children, went to school. Remember, they've come from Nigeria, English-speaking, into Niger, French-speaking. So the young children could go to school and learn French very quickly. The older children, UNHCR, managed to set up distance learning teaching from Nigeria so that they could actually finish their education from Nigeria while they were refugees in Niger. These are people who had actually seen their friends have their throats cut because they could speak English. So what's it been like in Europe? Well, to be fair, Germany has received the most refugee applications in 2015. Sweden came second in that list. The United States was third. And Russian Federation came fourth, which probably surprises you. But remember, in the countries that have the most refugees, there's no possibility of filing a claim for refugee status. So is there a crisis in Europe? The answer to that is no. Well, there is if you're a refugee. That's a crisis, because with the slow procedures, the use of detention, the border controls, and let's face it, the border controls in Europe have included razor wire, tear gas, and water cannon. That's a crisis. Detention is a crisis. The inability to access education, employment, and healthcare easily is a crisis. But for Europe itself, which is one of the richest regions on the planet, that's not experiencing a crisis. Not on the scale of Turkey, not on the scale of Lebanon, not on the scale of Jordan. The failure within the European Union to agree to implement its own responsibility sharing, which was established at the beginning of 2016, indicates the level of crisis. Yesterday, the International Organization for Migration reported that since the outset of the sharing program, Finland had accepted 38 unaccompanied children, which IOM had facilitated. The rest of the European Union, in that same period, together had managed to accept 4 unaccompanied children. In the words of the United Nations Secretary General, we have a refugee crisis that is just as much about a crisis of solidarity as it is to do with the sheer scale of numbers seeking protection. The lack of political leadership in the global north, Angela Merkel accepted. And if there isn't somebody in Norway thinking, who can we give the Nobel Peace Prize to this year, then they really should pull a finger out and think, okay. You need leadership. The leadership deals with the popular fears, okay, that's at the root of all this. Niger, by the way, it is the Nigerian government, in consultation with the UNHCR, that trains its own local government people. It goes out to the towns so that they actually see how to do refugee protection. In Colombia, where they passed a law in 2011 to deal in part with land restitution for the internally displaced, they have set up the land restitution unit, which if there is any hint that there was a human rights violation that led to displacement in the first place, presumes there is a right to return to that land and have the land handed back, no matter who's got it now. Again, in consultation with UNHCR and the rest of the UN, using the United Nations Development Programme, if you take a look at how to respond to refugees, you've got to think that the modal average time is 20 years. 20 years needs not just humanitarian protection at the outset, it needs a development programme. Not in the rich countries like Australia, like the UK, but in the poorer countries of the world where they're all hosted. You need UNDP, UNHCR and the rest of the UN working together. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Lines.
You can find us on iTunes or any podcasting app that you like. If you do use iTunes or the Apple podcast app, please leave us a rating or a review. It really makes a big difference. It helps other people find out about the podcast.